This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Well, congratulations for surviving the polar vortex of 2014. It was a blistering 70 degrees outside in the great state of Arizona. Welcome. Thank you for spending some time with us. Today's there's some reflection, there's some pontificating, and there is an expert with us. Actually, an Arizona alumni, a columnist and author. He's currently a columnist for the Seattle Times, but a alumni of the Arizona Republic. Welcome to the show, John Talton.
Hi, I'm glad to be with you.
Glad to have you back, John. I asked you to come here because I think you have been one of the most, over the years, one of the most reflective observers on Arizona history. And you are, as Mike noted, a native. And so you've got a long history here. I wonder, from a historical perspective, tell us now, from your perspective, who runs Arizona?
Well, I have to be indulged to say that I still write about Arizona on my blog, which is called Rogue Columnist, and it's at roguecolumnist.com.
It's a good read, and I was going to get there. I commend it to anybody who'd like a kind of another perspective on how Arizona is run.
Forgive ego me for stepping in there. Who runs Arizona now? It's a fascinating question because in many ways, Arizona's economy is run from out of state an astounding degree for a state as populous as Arizona. And so you don't have the old Phoenix 40-style business leaders making key decisions about investment and employment. And that's not true in every case, but
can I ask, because not all our listeners will recognize that. You use the phrase Phoenix 40. Tell us who they are and what they did.
Well, the Phoenix 40 was a name that came about in the 1970s to apply to the 40 most powerful chief executives in the city. And this actually predates the name and the formation of the organization. But Old Phoenix was very much run by its local businessmen and, in a few cases, businesswomen whose companies were headquartered in Phoenix and were very much tied to the health of the city. So the health of their companies and the health of the city were very much the same thing. Now, in today's globalized economy, Phoenix is very much a back office city, and we've lost the old civic stewards, the headquarters like Valley National Bank and Greyhound Dial Viad, although a little bitty Viad is still there. And it's been mostly replaced by being an out-of-state situation. And this is different from, say, a Seattle, where you still have a lot of headquarters here. And not only that, they're headquartered downtown, and they're very much invested in the community. So these are headquarters with thousands of people, not headquarters with a few scores of people in North Scottsdale.
There was and just to prove to you that I've read your blog, just a wonderfully, artfully crafted sentence in it about the Phoenix 40, and you wrote, quote, "The legendary group morphed into the benign and toothless Greater Phoenix Leadership." And subtext to that, I think, is, and they absented themselves from local politics. Is that right?
Well, I do not want beat up on Greater Phoenix Leadership or any of these other civic organizations. They do the best they can. They mean well. But in a healthy city, you have to have CEOs and stewards who can knock heads and write checks. And Phoenix doesn't have that as much. And yes, they were absolutely involved in politics, the old Phoenix 40, and especially what predated them, because Phoenix as a quote-unquote clean city directly grew out of the business leadership of the 1940s, which created the charter government movement.
And that originally came about for an entirely benign set of reasons to clean up corruption in the city. Is that right?
Well, the victors write history, as they say. And so Old Phoenix may not have been as corrupt as the Victors make it out to be, but it was pretty corrupt. City Hall was very bribable. There are these wonderful old stories about the old city commissioners running prostitution on the south side and getting so drunk in his office, one of them, that the police had to be called, and the police were called, and then they drove him home, and nothing came of it. And this new generation of businessmen like Eugene C. Pulliam of the Arizona Republic and Barry Goldwater of Goldwater's Department Stores and Frank Snell, the lawyer, they all were very concerned about what this meant for Phoenix's ability to grow and compete. It became an issue during World War II when the city was declared off limits for a moment. And then afterwards, they wanted to see the city grow and become a real competitive major American city. And to do that, they felt that city government had to be cleaned up, and they created charter government, which changed the city charter gradually to create the council-manager form of government, not exactly as we have it today, but generally so, where you have a professional city manager and it's much less bribable.
So who's taking their place? Is this the Tea Party?
Sure. I mean, I'm not sure anybody politically runs Arizona. There's not a John Rhodes or a Paul Fannin or a Barry Goldwater or an Alfredo Gutierrez or a Burton Barr anymore. But there's a very powerful Republican Party, and it is very much a Tea Party, right-wing Republican Party. The LDS Church exerts tremendous political power. The real estate industry exerts tremendous political power. And I'm not casting stones in any direction, but if you want to say who runs Arizona, those are some of the big entities and associational groups.
So it used to be the ones that were creating jobs. Now it's the ones that are paying for jobs and maybe even buying some votes in some cases. John Talton is our guest. We'll get back right after this. It is The Think Tank.
You're listening to The Think Tank on The Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here in The Think Tank with John Talton, a former columnist for the Arizona Republic who currently writes for the Seattle Times. And also the author of, the continuing author of RogueColumnist.com. One of the things that you have written, John, most passionately about over the years is observations on development in Metro Phoenix. And I wonder if you could comment on your take on the nature of kind of urban form and how this town has developed.
Well, our urban form in Phoenix is to spread out and keep spreading out. And this has had some consequences as the place has gotten bigger and bigger. It didn't have as many consequences when, say, there were a million people in the entire state and Metro Phoenix maybe had 400,000. But what you have is a highly inefficient form of development. It's very costly. It has raised the temperatures 10 degrees in my lifetime because of doing away with agriculture and desert and paving it over with concrete. Infrastructure and mass transit can't keep up with it. And then we leave behind these linear slums because we tend to buy these, we tend to build these starter homes or low-priced houses. And so they're left behind as the development machine moves farther and farther out on the fringes.
Maryvale comes to mind. I think that's probably
well, it does, but it's certainly not the only one. I mean, you have this inside the city of Mesa and in other places. Here's the deal: if you want to be competitive in the world economy, you want to attract talent and capital, and so you need to give them choices. And so every place Phoenix is competing against has plenty of malls and plenty of subdivisions and its own version of Scottsdale. But the best cities, the most competitive cities, also have real downtowns. They have a lot of choices in urban living. They have better transit, although we did build light rail, and thank God for that. So just from a competitive standpoint, Phoenix needs to fill in its central city, but also from an efficiency standpoint and an environmental standpoint.
Now, what you talk about is inner city. Talk about maybe it's downtown, Phoenix in general. We've tried that.
I think we've
tried that. I think the Mercado was one thing we were trying. We've tried that. What didn't we do right? How can we get it right?
First of all, when I talk about the central city, I think you need to start with downtown, and that runs from the railroad tracks to Fillmore or Roosevelt, if you're liberal, and from 7th Avenue to 7th Street. And then the central corridor running north to Camelback. And you need to get that right first before you say that infill is 44th Street and Camelback, or that infill is Bell and 56th Street.
How do you get step one right?
It's very difficult because you don't have major headquarters companies, you don't have a lot of people with urban values, and you don't have a lot of private sector capital. And that's what needs to be the focus, is how to get that private sector capital into the central city and onto the light rail line. I think that Mayor Stanton is interested in doing this. There are projects that can work and be successful, and downtown is way better off than it was 30 years ago or 20 years ago. The ASU campus is a huge success.
That's the biggest change that I've seen. ASU downtown, I mean, in contrast to before, the big sports venue seemed to bring people down for a few hours and then trying to do restaurants. But ASU downtown.
I mean, you know, in Denver, you've got all the sports stadiums downtown, and you also have offices and places to live, and you want it to be live, work, play, so people don't have to have a car. But getting the private sector investment into the central core is absolutely critical, and it can't be this kind of one-off thing, although we've had some good one-offs. The Phoenix Civic Center is, or rather the Convention Center is a great example of a one-off that will, in the long run, pay off well. Cityscape is good. I wish it wasn't so inward-facing and so suburban. But we need to find ways to build critical mass with small-scale retail, with fine-grained human connections so that people can walk, with shade. We desperately need shade all over the central core. It used to be a wonderful oasis. It is battling against the real estate interests that want to focus on building out on the fringe. And so it's not going to be easy. It's also battling against the city council, where every city council member is the mayor of his or her district and wants that to have the same priority as the central core. But if you don't have a healthy central core, the problems spread out, and we see that in the linear slums of Phoenix.
Now, I can anticipate, and I've heard this on the part of developers, their response to this would be, we're just giving people what they want. And when people move to Phoenix, what they want is a quarter acre of grass and a swimming pool.
Well, I wish they'd give them a quarter acre of grass. What they're doing now is just throwing down gravel and concrete, making it worse. But look, there's a whole lot of people who want center city living. And we just lack the developers in the main, not everybody. There are some exceptions, but for the most part, we lack the developers with the capital who have the ability to pull off really good, attractive center city projects. One Lexington, big success, but there you had a developer from Vancouver who absolutely got urban. Suburban developers are never going to get it. You know, Drew Brown, I love him. He's never going to get it. That's not what DMB does.
So what does it take bringing in entire – I mean, is it money, really, or is it vision? And I think you're saying that the people here don't have that vision, and the implication of that would be what we need is another cast of developers to develop the infill?
if I could just wave a wand, I would have, number one, several corporate headquarters in the Central Core that employed several thousand people. The second thing I would do is have the incentives in place, like tax increment financing, that would encourage development in the Central Core and in the existing urban footprint, and then taxing the externality costs of sprawl development so that it actually pays its way for the added heat island and commuting and smog that it creates.
I think I just heard the screams of suburban developers on that one.
There's a reason I was thrown out of Phoenix, although I still come back. Most of all, you've got to get private sector development that's interested in urban, and then the kinds of companies that attract young talent and people with urban values. And look, there's a lot of people in Phoenix who would love to live closer in and have their jobs closer in. The most successful neighborhoods in the city are places like Willow and FQ Story and Roosevelt. These are beautiful neighborhoods, disclosure, I grew up in Willow and lived there when I was in Phoenix again. But these neighborhoods are highly desirable, and they're expensive, so it shows people will pay for it. So it's not as if there's not demand.
So, you know, I listened to you talk about, well, we would love to bring in three major corporate headquarters. I'm sure that the people at GPEC would agree with that. How do you do that?
I want to get to that right after a break. You're right here in the think tank with Mike O'Neill, Mike Russell, and John Talton is our guest. More on how to get Phoenix right next.
You're listening to the think tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are here in the think tank with John Talton, longtime observer of Phoenix and Arizona trends, and the author of RogueColumnist.com, which I highly recommend. We were talking about growth, development, and I was listening to some of what you said, and it sounded to me like it had a chicken-egg aspect to it. In other words, we would love to bring in, you know, three major headquarters downtown. I'm sure that economic development people would be all for that. But they're not going to come, I think was an undercurrent in what you said, unless we have certain kinds of infrastructure and lifestyle. Do I have that right, and how do you prime the pump to the extent that that's the case?
It's very difficult, and I want to frame it by saying that this is not an either-or thing. It's not all about Phoenix is doing everything wrong, and we're so depressed, or Talton's an idiot. I mean, Talton may be an idiot, but Phoenix is doing many things right. It's just that Phoenix is underperforming its peer cities, and here's the deal. Especially after the Great Depression, city advantages are being frozen into place. It's very hard to argue that so-and-so is going to be the next Silicon Valley. So the places that came to the recession with tremendous advantages in talent and high income and high-wage jobs and headquarters have largely retained that. The cities that are ambitious and want to try to build something are facing a much tougher grind in a slow-growth economy. So, yes, there is a certain chicken-and-egg aspect to it. Phoenix has lost a lot. People don't realize Phoenix used to have a great downtown. Phoenix used to have a lot of headquarters companies. Phoenix used to have a lot of civic stewards who were deeply invested in the health of the city. Phoenix used to be a lot more pluralistically politically. It used to be a competitive two-party state, or Arizona, rather. I don't have the magic wand to that. I think focusing on quality of life and focusing on the Central Core as the laboratory of getting all that land banked land into productive use and creating more walkable neighborhoods and having recruitment that is focused specifically on companies for the Central Core, even on a small scale, will be a beginning. And then we've got to address things that can draw more young talent. We don't have that.
Well, I think I've seen evidence, and I think it's consistent with this. There's evidence that Phoenix is just generally not seen as a cool place for young millennial college-educated recent graduates.
But I got a challenge on that because ASU has such a high population. ASU is the most populated campus in the country. Mm-hmm. So obviously we're a cool place to go. Why aren't we keeping them here is the question. What is holding a corporation back from saying, I need to move to Arizona. I need to park right there at Tempe because I'm going to get the best and the brightest right out of school?
Fair question, John.
Well, it's very competitive. And so if you come out of ASU and you are the best and the brightest, you're probably going to go to a place like Seattle that already has a cool city where you can get a very high-paying job at Amazon, which has like 15,000 people two blocks away from me. And so the competition that Phoenix faces is incredible. And yes, ASU is a big, populous school, and Michael Crow has done a great job, and before him, Laddie Coor did a great job. But you have cities like Pittsburgh that have some great universities, but they're not able to retain that talent. And so retaining the talent and drawing world talent, and we're not talking about just millennials and latte-quaffing creative class people, but drawing the talent is one of the key challenges. One of the things you've got to get beyond is this kind of one flavor of largely a dependence on low-wage jobs and call center kinds of jobs and these very long commutes, and there are some exceptions like Intel. Intel's a great thing to have. Intel would be wonderful if you were the size of Tulsa. But Phoenix is the sixth largest city in the country. It's 14th or 13th largest metro area. In no way is it competitive with other metros and cities of its size. It doesn't even want to have this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I do see that. I spent a fair chunk of time in Silicon Valley, and you reference something like an Intel or something, and they've got a couple of dozen of them.
Well, and more than that, they've got major, two world-class research universities, as well as San Jose State. Nobody's going to completely replicate Silicon Valley, but you can look at best practices in a San Diego, in a Denver, in a Seattle, in a Portland, and I know this just drives everybody to their gun cabinet to hear these things. Okay, look at Dallas-Fort Worth. That's a good red state. Dallas-Fort Worth, Austin, Houston, you're not going to be the center of the world's oil industry, but there are best practices to be learned there.
So if you were to try to, within the, not quite the magic wand, but within the realm of the possible, you had the ability to do one or two or three things to attempt to kind of move the needle in this regard, at a practical, achievable level, what would you suggest?
Well, I think one thing is to ensure that the gains that have been made are preserved. And so that means continuing to grow and ensure the viability and the attractiveness of the downtown ASU campus and the Tempe campus, for that matter, to continue to make sure that light rail is clean, convenient, fast, regular, expand it to the places where you can get the most number of passengers. And so we could go down a whole list of that, but it's kind of like preserve the gains that have been done and then do no harm. I think a second thing is an absolute focus on livability, and so that means more shade. It means water investments into shade trees, and especially in the historic Oasis, not throwing down gravel but planting grass. It's always been an oasis. It should be an oasis. I'm not talking about out in the middle of nowhere, but I'm talking about in the central core. Focus on livability, walkability, convenience, and then get an economic development strategy in place that is doable, that is focused on the central core. And this is not the same mission that GPEG does. Barry Broom's a good guy, But he has to look out for the entire metro area, and the metro area has a tendency to fight itself and cannibalize itself instead of going off and fighting for jobs somewhere else.
We have about a minute and a half. I've got a quick question about that. What have we done that just didn't work? What was a good idea but red tape got in the way?
As far as the Central Core goes?
Sure.
Well, I think that if you go back and look at the list of sins, one of the biggest sins was to, number one, allow for upzoning of lots outside of downtown.
Oh, okay.
And so that it made the land totally economically unviable. You know, we're not going to see another skyscraper on the Central Corridor probably in my lifetime. But now that land is banked. And the second sin was allowing for teardowns so that you have these perfectly usable small buildings, one or two stories, that would fit small companies, small tech companies, or retailers, just torn down. There's no major city in America that has as much empty land as Phoenix does. So those are two big, big sins that set us off on the wrong path.
Now, that's empty land, right? That's not
right.
Owned land. It's not like it's just sitting there with a for sale sign on it, correct?
Well, it's got a for sale sign on it if you're willing to pay enough.
And, sure.
And it's not economically viable for a developer to try to make it happen. Northwest corner of McDowell and Central is a classic example. It's just overpriced.
And it's sat there for a long, long time.
It's been sitting there at least since the early 90s when they tore down the old AT&T buildings.
All right. John Talton has been our guest. Thanks so much for joining us. You've shown us a way in for a guy that claims he's been kicked out of Phoenix. We'd sure like to have you back. How do we get you back, by the way? Is this a financial thing?
You just pay me. I mean, I still own property in Phoenix.
Okay, good.
My family's been there for four generations.
I will double your fee next time, John.
All right.
John, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. As always, Dr. Mike O'Neill and myself wrap it up, put a big fat bow on it. We're going to do that when we come back to the Think Tank. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
And another thank you to John Talton for joining us. He's an economics columnist. Good grief. These guys that know numbers, I'm telling you, they're impressive. With the Seattle Times and an Arizona Republic alumni. And he's got a blog, right, Doc? It's got a blog, roguecolumnist.com. Check it out, will you? And while you're online, by the way, go ahead and click on over to O'NeillResearch.com. That's Dr. Mike's day job over there, as well as MikeO'Neill.org.
Which, by the way, has archived all of our old shows.
Check
the
that
stuff
out.
That's not
you
on the
KTAR.
Can't
get enough. 1 hour is not enough of us.
Right. The
1 hour
is not
enough.
Has been around the KTAR website long enough to catch dust, we put it on MikeO'Neill.org.
Yeah, you know, that's how we do things. But we make it better. If 1 hour is not enough for you, which it never is, go jump on over to MikeO'Neill.org. All right, John brought up a lot of stuff. We were talking about Phoenix, about Phoenix past. What's wrong with Phoenix? Why we need to start in the middle? As a 12-year veteran of the real estate industry here in Arizona, I giggled a couple of times because downtown, there's no reason for anyone to go downtown. I don't think putting trees and planting grass is going to help us there. What say you?
Well, I see the biggest change, and we mentioned it earlier, is ASU. That brings bodies downtown, 10,000 students, workers, faculty, a lot of whom would like to live in the area, some of whom are.
There's been an ASU campus downtown for a while
but it's really taken off in the last few years. I mean,
right.
It was nothing for a while. And I see that as the biggest single change because I think back historically, we brought in a sports venue and that gave us a crowd for a few hours and people didn't even stick around to eat.
Right.
You know? And then you brought another and you started to get a few restaurants. And then Phoenix downtown became a place to go to but then turn around and leave, get in your car. You know, build a lot of parking garages and freeways so people can get out. Around the university, I think it attracts a group of people who would like to stay. Some of them are. And I think that's the kind of stuff that he was talking about. Build an environment where people want to live. You know, I hate to get personal about this, but on the subject of, you know, bright, educated millennials, One of them is a nephew of mine, just graduated. Right. He's a young architect with a master's degree from the East Coast, wants to move somewhere else. I offered him free lodging. That wasn't good enough to bring him to Phoenix. Without a job, you know where he's going?
Where?
He's going to Seattle.
Okay.
He wants to arrive there, sell his van, get rid of a car, and be a pedestrian.
Here's the good part about people moving to Seattle. There always comes a point where us Phoenicians can say, ha, we told you so. You should have come here as you're crying in your milk because you're suffering from depression of all the rain and the weather up there. But here's the deal. If you talk about ASU being such a catalyst for downtown, why isn't it such a catalyst for Tempe? Well, I mean, I understand there's people living there, but it's not the young millennials that you fight so desperately for. Well,
first of all, historically, and no longer completely the case, but historically, Tempe ASU was a commuter campus.
Okay.
Kids came from the Phoenix area, they went to school, and they got in their cars, and they went home. Now, they're building a lot of dorms, and there's a development along Apache where that is changing. But Tempe is not the urban core. Phoenix is. So I think that the other thing is that, downtown in the Metro Phoenix area was, if you asked people 20 years ago, where's the best place to go in downtown Phoenix, the answer was Mill Avenue in Tempe.
Right.
Because
well, there was a Hooters downtown, so everybody, it's got a Hooters.
The core of pedestrians are what make something like that feasible. So all of a sudden, you move in 10,000 students into downtown Phoenix. There is, I think, potential there that has not been there before.
You know what I think this is, Doc? A lot of this is we were so used to just steady 6-8% growth. We were just chugging right along, and then we saw our spikes. Then we got used to the spike. We're like, "Whoa, everything's great!"
Absolutely, and we assumed that was normal and would continue forever.
And here we are now. But now that we're stabilizing, now that we're stabilizing, I think we want that spike back so desperately. Yeah. It starts to. Well, what do we do? How do we do it? I think we just get back to dance with the one that brought you. Stay the course. Arizona's fine. I don't think Phoenix needs to take any drastic steps right now. Do you?
I think it depends on what industry you're in and what you're trying to do. I think that we have been populated excessively by low-wage jobs.
That is a good point.
We do have, and off air, John pointed out, there is data when I pressed him on the issue. Well, you know, is there really data that people are leaving, educated people are leaving here? And he says, yes, under 25, college educated, we are way below national norms. That says people are leaving here, a lot of them educated here and going somewhere else. So that is indicative of a problem. And there are certain things I think that groups like that want. And some of the amenities that group wants, they're not finding it here.
All right, let's shift gears here as we... or now gearing up. I'm so excited. I love election years. I just
politics.
Keep up with all this stuff. There's a new player in our gubernatorial race, is there not?
I think potentially a big one. Scott Smith is in.
Tell not, me, not, Dem, not, for those that don't know, we were talking with an R or D.
He's a Republican.
Republican, thank
mayor
you.
Of Mesa, conservative businessman, has been mayor, had no prior job in politics before being elected to the office of Mayor Mesa. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people said he's done a lot of really good things there. You talk about bringing in the kind of community that people want.
He brought Apple. He brought the crown jewel of the economy.
And that may even not be big. Like 6 or 8 smaller colleges and universities to downtown Mesa. Again, that's a big thing. One of the reasons why ASU, by the way, got so big is that we were the largest metropolitan area in the country that essentially had one institution of higher learning. ASU got it all. Mm-hmm. 6 or 8 of them into Mesa. That's the kind of, you know, good, clean, high-paying, high-tech kind of work thing that you want. Done a lot of things there. And I think what is intriguing to me about his potential is that I think people overread this notion that, the Arizona primary is all Tea Party and ultra, ultra conservative. That is a component. That is a majority. But think of it this way. If Scott Smith can grab the 40% of mainline conservative Republican business types, then there's 4 or 5 other candidates that can split up that other 60%. If I were him, I'd like that arithmetic.
I think I won't disagree with you there, but I will tell you, a new study out from Gallup, 42% of Americans identify themselves as independents.
That's been a long-term trend.
And it does, and I don't think Arizona is excluded from that.
Not at all. There are more independents than there are either Republicans or Democrats. That has been a long-term trend. In terms of partisanship, however, a lot of those independents do have leanings. And even net of the independents, there's still a Republican plurality here, about 6%. That hasn't changed. They'd love to see them all be Republicans. There's two kinds of independents, I think. There's the ones that are truly independents, actually a small piece of that. Most of the independents have leanings one way or the other.
But they just don't like what they see on their team.
I think it's a reflection of we look out and there's a lot about politics that we don't like in terms of partisan politics. And we are available if somebody can come out to us and say, we're not going to just play the same old game.
And what we've seen time and time again is that, let's say it were Democrat getting a little disenfranchised by the Democrat Party. Now I'm an independent now. Yep. Doesn't mean they're going to, you would have to pay them to go vote for a Republican.
And conversely,
exactly, absolutely.
Yep.
And so what it does is it pulls voters out. It lowers our voter base. By numbers, who does that help?
But thus far, the net is equal. I mean, it's drawing at this point equally from both sides. But I think what it is to both parties, it's a danger sign. It says, we don't like what you're doing. Mm-hmm. We don't like the way you're behaving. We don't like the fact that nobody can seem to sit down and cut a deal on anything. And we are at least potentially available. But as of right now, you only have two choices. And when most of those people end up voting, the disaffected Democrat is probably going to hold his nose and vote Democratic. Conversely, likewise, the Republican who turned independent, who says, you know, my vote's available, but for the most part, it would be a big stretch to vote Democratic.
Right. And then how does that affect our gubernatorial race?
I think it says that if you can get through the primary, somebody like Scott Smith probably gets a boost there.
Okay.
Because it's the Republican who is least extreme, okay? Now, Democrats don't have that. They managed to settle on a candidate. So if you... If you put yourself in a position where you are saying, listen, I'm centrist, I'm mainstream, I'm still conservative, I'm a business guy and all that. If you get through the primary, then Scott Smith looks really, really good to me.
All right. Now on the Democrat side, what's going on there?
Fred Duvall managed to scare off all the opponents.
So
what's going to happen is for the next 8 months, we're going to hear tons and tons about intra-fighting within the Republican Party. We're not going to hear a darn thing about Fred Duvall. Come September, when the general election starts, people will have to be reminded of who he is. Now, does that work for his advantage or not?
Yes, absolutely, it does.
Not necessarily.
Really?
If the Republican primary is really, really nasty and everybody cuts themselves together with knives and come out bleeding, then Fred Duvall is the one man standing. The problem he's going to face in September is nobody's going to know who he is.
Okay, but I'll say it's the Hillary Clinton defense. I mean, excuse me, the Hillary Clinton model. You don't hear a lot from her these days.
Because she's out there, she doesn't need the difference is Hillary doesn't need the name identification.
That's true.
In two years from now, nobody's going to forget who Hillary is.
But that's true. But she is doing the lie in wait and let everyone else fall on their swords and then I will stand up. Hey, look at me.
Because she is the heir apparent. She can do that.
Right. Now, is Jan Brewer running?
No. I just say no.
No.
It will knock me off this chair if she declares.
Now let's go back to what we were talking about. Who is the best for Phoenix infrastructure, Phoenix growth on the gubernatorial ticket right now?
Ooh. You know, I think Scott Smith can make a if you look at what he did in Mesa, the actual accomplishments in terms of the kinds of things he brought in, I think he can make a pretty good case. You know, I'm not saying he's the best. I'm saying he's got a record and he can cite a lot of stuff. And I find it difficult to see anybody on either side of the aisle that can tout the same record.
Look, so. I like having somebody that's been there, done that. Thanks for being with us. This is Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.